It's no secret that legacy media is facing a crisis. It's been in crisis mode, really, from the turn of the century. Traditional media outlets like newspapers, television and radio stations have had their business model upended by the internet, social media, and now AI. Newspapers in America are closing their doors at a rate of 2 per week, according to one study, while in Australia, over 200 local newspapers have disappeared over the past 15 years. Earlier this year, The Washington Post, which is owned by the billionaire Jeff Bezos, axed over 300 jobs in a move employees described as a bloodbath. I've been talking to the former executive editor of The Washington Post, Marty Baron, one of the most highly respected figures in global journalism. We discuss Jeff Bezos, AI, and inevitably, Donald J. Trump. Marty Baron, welcome to ABC Radio National.
Thank you for having me.
Marty, you were the executive editor of The Washington Post until 2021, and you called the staff cuts early this year one of the darkest days in the paper's 148-year history. I wonder what sort of shape the Washington Post is in now.
Well, I do think it was a dark day. They lost a lot of talent. A lot of people, of course, were laid off, and then many people have left since, even people who kept their job. And their ambitions now are, I would say, sharply diminished in comparison to what they were before. That said, the news department, which is separate from the opinion department, you know, we have this tradition of a wall between the two here in the United States. The news department continues to do some really exceptional work day in and day out. And I admire the work they're doing. I support the work that they're doing. They have a lot of scoops. They continue to hold Trump accountable. And I think they have every right to be proud of that and that people should appreciate it and support it. The opinion pages, I think, have gone in a very strange direction under basically the instructions of the owner, Jeff Bezos. And I'm not as enamored of them. I think they show an incredible timidity when it comes to Donald Trump and almost a deference to him, even though they do criticize him from time to time. But I think they're kind of soft on him in a way that isn't deserved. But I mourn the flight of talent of the people they've laid off and then the people who have decided to depart because they're disenchanted with the ownership and they've been disenchanted with the business management.
Its billionaire owner Jeff Bezos said at the time, and I quote, "Each and every day our readers give us a roadmap to success. The data tells us what's valuable and where to focus." Jeff Bezos has made an awful lot of money understanding what customers want, predicting what they want next. But what do you think of that as a journalistic mission statement?
Yeah, it's not a journalistic statement. When I started in this business, which was in 1976, I was working for the Miami Herald. And Jack Knight, who was one of two brothers who ran the parent company, which had a lot of newspapers, was a very large media institution. He had a principle, and it was get the truth and publish it. That's a journalistic instruction to people. And then I concluded my career, as you noted, at the Washington Post. Spent more than 8 years there as its executive editor. And every day when you walked in that newsroom, the principles that were set down in 1935 were on the wall, and I looked at them every single day. And the very first principle talks about telling the truth as nearly as the truth may be ascertained, which suggests that there's a goal. It's a hard process. We never know it completely. We have to keep working at it. We keep learning. But the goal is to publish the truth. That too, is a journalistic instruction. But just saying, let's follow the data is not a journalistic instruction. And I think that you have to have your own compass. If you're owning a newspaper, owning a media outlet, if you're running it, if you're an editor or a publisher. And it's a little bit like saying, we're going to set sail and we'll let the wind take us wherever the wind takes us. And then you crash on the rocky shore. You should be saying, this is the destination that we wish to reach, and we're going to use the wind to get us there, the wind being the data. You obviously cannot run a business without data. It's important, but you have to have a goal. You have to have ambitions. You have to have core principles, and they should really help set your course.
I look back, Marty, on the reporting of the first Trump administration as something of a golden age in print journalism. Almost every day, it seemed, the Washington Post or the New York Times would produce a major scoop. In all my years covering Washington, I had never seen anything like it. It was journalistically thrilling. The Post was very strong. It was very robust. It came up with that motto, didn't it? Democracy dies in darkness. It seemed back then that Jeff Bezos was a white knight, a savior of the legacy media. I wonder what it was like to work with him back then.
It was a great experience for me, frankly. I thought he was a very good owner during that period. Things have changed since, but he was a great owner during that period. He gave us our independence. He basically set a new strategy for the Post to become national and international even. He gave us the resources to innovate, and we did. And things worked. They clicked. By the time I left, we had almost 3 million digital subscribers. At one point, our traffic exceeded that of the New York Times. We were doing, as you noted, incredible journalism, one scoop after the next, fulfilling our mission of keeping watch on our government, as we always should, regardless of who happens to be in the White House. And we were competing vigorously with the New York Times and with other media outlets as well. So he reveled in that. He encouraged us. He praised us to the heavens. He allowed us our independence. He had good ideas for how we could manage the business and deploy technology and all of that. Obviously, as you noted, he founded a big consumer business and understands the consumer business, or at least did, with respect to the Washington Post. So I enjoyed talking to him. I had a good time when I talked to him, and in formal and informal settings. And I was pleased to work for him at that time.
He paid $250 million for the Post, didn't he? But you would joke with him that the price tag far exceeded that, because during Trump 1.0, the government decided not to give a key contract to Amazon. Tell us about that moment, Marty.
Sure. Well, this was toward the end of the first Trump administration. Amazon was competing with others for a $10 billion cloud computing contract with the Department of Defense. It was considered to be the leading competitor because it basically pioneered the field of cloud computing. It had already had a lot of contracts with the intelligence agencies, with the Defense Department. And Trump, who was very upset with Jeff Bezos, perceived him as a political enemy for one reason and one reason only, which was the coverage of the Washington Post. He intervened in that bidding process with the goal of trying to make sure that that contract did not go to Amazon. And it did not go to Amazon initially. And then there was litigation after that. And in that litigation, Amazon actually, with the approval of Jeff Bezos, actually sought to have Donald Trump deposed to provide a sworn deposition, to submit himself to questioning. And that's extraordinary, that a private company would ask to have the president, the sitting president of the United States, deposed. And Jeff Bezos supported that at the time, which demonstrates just how much he defended us in the face of extraordinary pressure from the president of the United States, who is unquestionably the most powerful person in the world. Things have changed since then, I think, but at the time, he stood up for us, and I was and remain very grateful for that.
You spoke about how things have changed since, and there was a key moment, wasn't there? During the 2024 presidential campaign, Jeff Bezos decides to pull a planned editorial which would have endorsed the Democratic candidate, Kamala Harris. More than 200,000 people cancel their subscriptions. Then, when Donald Trump gets elected, Bezos gets this prime seat at the inauguration. What happened to the crusading Bezos that we saw in the first Trump administration and the more sort of, you know, sycophantic almost Jeff Bezos in the second?
Well, I can't get inside his head, but I think it's fairly clear that the big factor was fear. Fear of vengeance on the part of Jeff Bezos against Amazon and against Jeff Bezos's private space company, Blue Origin. Keep in mind that Amazon is the source of Jeff Bezos's wealth, and Blue Origin is the object of his passion. Space is his real passion. And the Post is neither of those. It's not his passion, and it's not definitely not the source of his wealth. And so I think that he feared that Donald Trump would cancel contracts with Amazon, that he would not give contracts to Blue Origin at an inflection point in the history of that private company of Jeff Bezos's, and that there would be huge consequences for Jeff Bezos and for Amazon, and he wanted to avoid that. He didn't have to interfere in the news coverage, but he did control the opinion pages, and he could make a decision to just cancel the editorial. I mean, why poke the bear? And I think that that's why he did it, is just so as not to antagonize Donald Trump at that particular moment.
You're listening to ABC Radio National, Saturday Extra with me, Nick Bryant, and I'm talking with the legendary American journalist, Marty Baron, the former executive editor of The Washington Post. Marty, it's not just The Washington Post that has gone through this kind of process. Right now, CBS News is in turmoil, and a similar dynamic is playing out. Billionaire owners who are more sympathetic now towards Donald Trump, in this case, ideologically aligned with Donald Trump as well. How big a problem is this, that the billionaire ownership of organizations like CBS, which is owned by Paramount, which is about to take over the company that owns CNN as well? I mean, what sort of health is the Fourth Estate in right now when it is controlled by these billionaires that are aligning themselves with Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's concerning. I mean, I think what you're seeing is consolidation in the traditional area of the news business, sort of the legacy media organizations. That is a declining portion of the business. Otherwise, you're seeing a lot of fragmentation. People who are on Substack, people who are on TikTok, people who are on YouTube, a lot of influencers, and you're seeing enormous fragmentation. But in the legacy area of the business, you're beginning to see consolidation, and the consolidation is, in some key instances, is taking place under the aegis of billionaires, and they have other business interests at stake. I mean, look, in the case of CBS, it was part of Paramount. Paramount was bought by Skydance, which was owned by Larry Ellison and his son, David, primarily Larry Ellison. And they're very close. Well, Larry Ellison is extremely close to Donald Trump. He was a Republican mega donor. The Washington Post reported back in 2020 that he had participated in a teleconference about how to reverse the results of the 2020 election. We don't know what he said during that teleconference, but that he was a participant in that teleconference. And so that's really concerning. And clearly, Skydance wanted to appease Donald Trump so that it could get approval for its acquisition of Paramount. For that reason, it settled litigation by Donald Trump against CBS for a ridiculous sum of $16 million. And now it has its eyes on Warner Brothers Discovery, which owns CNN. And it would like to get approval for that as well. And it looks like it will get approval. And it wanted, I think, clearly to demonstrate that it was going to make changes in these news organizations that Trump himself despises. The ownership promised changes to Donald Trump, and they seem to want to deliver. And so now they're trying to close the deal on Warner Brothers Discovery. And I think they've scored points with Donald Trump by the confrontation that they're having with the newsroom at CBS and at 60 Minutes in particular.
I suppose one of the arguments that some of these billionaire owners would put forward is that Donald Trump is more representative of America than a lot of people in the media would like to think. You know, his victory in 2016 wasn't an aberration. He proved that when he almost won the presidency again in 2020, and he proved that when he returned to the presidency in 2024, even after January the 6th. And I guess what they would say would, our coverage should reflect the fact that a lot of people like Donald Trump. You might not like him in the liberal media, but a lot of people do. What would you say to that argument?
Well, that's the political discussion and the political framing, and I just don't think of our mission as fundamentally political. I think our job is to find the facts and tell the public what the facts are, so that the public can make their own decisions. And if they choose Donald Trump, well, fine. They choose Donald Trump. That's what happens in a democracy. We certainly have a duty to cover the entirety of our communities and our country, to make sure that all people see themselves reflected fairly, accurately in our coverage, that they see that their struggles, their aspirations, their expectations are fairly reflected. We should do that. That is a responsibility of ours, and I think that's important to establishing our credibility. But I don't think that we should go about our work saying our job is to placate this particular political segment of our society. Our job is to appeal to this other segment of society. I don't agree with that approach. In fact, the management of CBS now has said their aim is to appeal to the center right and the center left. Well, I don't see that as a journalistic instruction. That's a political instruction. I mean, a story may well appeal to the center right, and it may or may not. It may well appeal to the center left, or it may not. But that's not how you should approach your work. You should approach your work in the way that the kind of instruction that I got at the beginning of my career, which is go find the truth and publish it, or what the principle at the Washington Post was to ascertain the truth, to tell the truth as nearly as it may be ascertained. And those are the kinds of instructions that I think that we ought to be giving our newsroom. It's not, let's do something to satisfy Donald Trump and his followers, or let's do something to appeal to the Democrats and their followers. That's a political instruction. It has almost nothing to do with good journalism, in my view.
Marcy, I wonder to what extent you think journalists might have contributed to the populist wave that is spreading around the world. I mean, when Donald Trump rose to prominence, he not only appealed to the hollowed out communities in the Rust Belt, he appealed to hollowed out newsrooms in New York and Washington. He threw them a lifeline. He was a clickbait candidate to end all clickbait candidates. He was a ratings juggernaut. It's something I've reflected on over the years, and I've always thought we were complicit in his rise, because we saw in Donald Trump somebody with maximum journalistic entertainment value, in the same way in Britain that we saw Boris Johnson as maximum journalistic entertainment value, and Nigel Farage, and here in Australia at the moment, Pauline Hanson. I wonder whether, you know, journalism has lost its way a little bit because of our kind of drama addiction. We kind of end up coming up with storylines that sort of comport with the narratives that give us maximum entertainment.
Well, I don't think we should generalize about the media performance. I mean, we're all very different. There are a lot that this notion that all media outlets behave exactly the same, I think, is a false one and is demonstrably false.
Obviously, yeah.
Now, do I think that some media outlets did exactly what you were talking about? Yes, I do. I mean, I think CNN in particular and Fox News in particular, they aired his rallies from beginning to end because they did draw a large audience. And were there other media outlets that covered him in a way because it drew a lot of traffic? No doubt. But I don't feel that all media outlets did that, and we certainly did not do that at the Washington Post.
Do you think Donald Trump poses a threat to the free press in the United States?
Oh, there's no question that he poses a threat to the free press in the United States. He talks about his commitment to free expression, but he only believes in free expression for people who support him. The measures that he's taken already in terms of bringing baseless lawsuits against media outlets, using the regulatory apparatus to harass media outlets, to threaten networks with the licenses for their station affiliates that they would be withdrawn, all sorts of other measures that he's taken, basically excluding real journalists from the Pentagon, you name it. There's just a long list of things that he has done, and that list continues to grow. That is an effort to delegitimize, marginalize, discredit, and ultimately and really dehumanize the media in this country. You can see by the way that he speaks to journalists, using the language that denigrates people, that treats them as garbage, which is what he calls them. And not only has he called journalists garbage and scum, but he calls them enemies of the people, which is the language that authoritarians historically have used to describe an independent press. He doesn't want an independent press. He wants a press that is servile and that basically functions as his stenographer, or better yet, his propagandist.
Marcy, as we bring this interview to an end, what would be your advice to a young journalist starting out in the age of Donald Trump, in the age of artificial intelligence?
Well, first of all, if somebody's passionate about getting into the field, I would encourage them to do that. We need really good journalists, and we need good journalism if we are to maintain a democracy. There's never been a democracy without a free and independent press, and there never will be one. And you can see that authoritarians, one of the first measures they take as they try to accumulate power is to suppress a free press. So for talented people, I encourage them to go in. What I would encourage people who get into the field to do is to recognize what our core values are, what mission we have to serve of providing the public the information it needs and deserves to know so that people can govern themselves, and to stick to those missions fearlessly. But at the same time, to recognize that the way that people are consuming information is changing dramatically. And so if the way that they're consuming information is changing, the way that we deliver information has to change as well. And so whoever gets into the field needs to recognize that technology is changing the way that we're going to be delivering information. We need not only to adapt to that, we need to embrace that, and we need to recognize that it's not going to stop changing, that instability is essentially a permanent condition of our business, and we should just get comfortable with discomfort.
Marty Baron, former executive editor of the Washington Post and an elder of our industry. Thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.